Miko Pella's book speaks to readers from an unusual perspective. Miko is the son of one of Israel's leading generals, Matti Peled, who was instrumental in Israel's dramatic victory over Egypt in 1967, but who soon afterward became a leading advocate for Palestinian statehood. Miko's own journey led him to discover what had caused his father to become an advocate for a two-state solution, and what led Miko to go beyond that to now support a single state for Israelis and Palestinians. His book, The General's Son, was particularly important for me because in the spring of 1983, I had the great fortune to meet and spend time with General Peled, arranging his media appearance in the Bay Area, and later that year spending Yom Kippur with him at his home in the hills outside of Jerusalem where Miko grew up. Miko Peled was born in Jerusalem in 1961 to a well-known Zionist family. His grandfather, Avraham Katznelson, was a Zionist leader and signer of Israel's Declaration of Independence. His father, Matti, was a young officer in 1948, and in 1967 was the general in charge of logistics in the war that led to the conquering of Egyptian Sinai, Syria's Golan Heights, and the West Bank and Gaza. Miko came to the United States, became an accomplished karate teacher, sixth degree black belt, and was living in San Diego when he learned in September 1997 that his niece, Madar, had been killed in a suicide attack in Jerusalem. It would be the first in a series of events that would transform his life and his perspective on the Israel-Palestine conflict, making him today one of the most important and outspoken advocates for justice in Palestine and for a single democratic state for Israelis and Palestinians. It's my great pleasure to welcome Miko Peled to Takes on the World. Hello, Miko.
Hi, good morning.
Great to have you on the air. Before we get to your very important book, I'd like to start with a critical article you posted on your blog yesterday, quote, Sweden and Britain have spoken, referring to the support the Swedish government and the British Parliament have offered a Palestinian state side by side with Israel. While many advocates for peaceful solutions to the Israel-Palestine conflict have welcomed the gestures from both countries, you describe them as, quote, Europeans once again trying to wash their hands of a problem they created and supported, end quote. And that one, quote, can hardly believe that they would cast such a meaningless, cowardly vote that makes not one iota of difference to anyone. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, the vote is not a vote for peace. It's a vote for the continuation of Israel's brutal oppression of the Palestinians. And it's a vote that allows Israel to continue and completely disregard any rights that Palestinians have to life or liberty or you know, period. The two-state solution is not a solution. The two-state solution is a sham. It's a sham that was put together and is being kept alive by Israel and its supporters. And Europeans know this. In other words, what I'm saying now is not something that people don't know. Europeans know that there's only way to bring about peace and justice in Palestine is to allow for the creation of a real democracy all over Palestine with Israelis and Palestinians as equals. As the state of Israel remains as it is, there will not be peace. Israel will never allow any other state to be established within the boundaries of what Israel considers to be the land of Israel. And so, and everybody knows this. In other words, it's a sham, and they are doing nothing except washing their hands, or trying to wash their hands, by with a meaningless, useless, and I would say insulting gesture.
And wouldn't you say, though, it reflects the need, the feeling from some politicians, particularly in Britain, that who were disgusted with what Israel's been doing, but nevertheless feel they have to make some kind of expression that doesn't get them attacked by the lobby as being anti-Semitic?
No, I think what this is more the British politicians realizing that there's a lot of pressure. I mean, when Israel conducted its latest incursion and massacre in Gaza this last summer, there were massive protests in London. And the British government and British politicians are realizing that the sentiment on the street is one that supports the Palestinian cause. Now, because they are They benefit greatly from their alliance with Israel. They are complicit with Israeli crimes by selling Israel weapons, and by, you know, maintaining defense contracts and other agreements with the state of Israel. Of course, it's a lot of money that they don't want to lose. They decide that they can do something which will be meaningless and at the same time will get them some, you know, some sense of relief because it is some support for the Palestinians. But the reality is, as long as you support the state of Israel, you cannot support the Palestinian cause. The two are at complete odds. You have to choose one or the other. And if you choose Israel, then you're choosing, you're voting against justice, you're voting for racism, and you're voting for violence against the Palestinians. So because the world has accepted this mythical notion of a two-state solution, they decided that this will be their refuge, and they use that as a refuge. And I think it's, like I said, I think it's insulting, and I think it's it'll backfire.
And well, in that context, for the 50 days this past summer, the people of Gaza experienced a third assault against them in 3 years by Israel. And this latest, the most devastating of all, with more than 2,100 killed, most civilians, many of them women and children, tens of thousands of homes as well as whole neighborhoods destroyed. It looked like Dresden. And yet there's no suggestion I've heard in the public sphere that either Israel or the United States, which supplied Israel with all the weapons of destruction, should be held responsible for the billions of reconstruction costs, not to mention war crimes, and Kerry even bragged that the U.S. had pledged $218 million in aid, which is $60 million less than Congress added to Israel's Iron Dome defense arsenal midway through the bombing. Perhaps you could comment on this total willingness of the world to give Israel a pass.
This time around, I mean, Israeli attacks and Israeli massacres in Gaza are nothing new. They've been going on since Israel created the Gaza Strip in the early 50s. Of course, technology has improved, so they're killing a lot more people in less time. But I think what is most puzzling about this latest attack is that we, all of us, and I was in Jerusalem at the time, but I know people here and people certainly in Europe, saw this happen live in real time. We saw this murder in cold blood of innocent civilians, over 2,000 of them, by a massive military force with no justification at all. I mean, not that there is any justification for murdering people. And nobody did a thing. Nobody did a thing. You know, I spoke, I've been speaking around the country a lot in a couple of places. People are quite proud, you know, in this city they had 2,000 people come out in March, you know, to support Gaza. Another city, maybe 6,000, and they're very proud. I said, there's nothing to be proud of. If all the world can do when we see murder of civilians in cold blood, and this is not, you know, somewhere in Afghanistan where people don't really understand where it is. We're talking about a place that's probably the highest profile location in the world, 3 hours flight from Paris, 4 hours flight from London. And nobody does a thing. And I think it's puzzling to people, their own inability to act, and then the unwillingness of governments, particularly in the West, but in other places too, in the Arab world too, to speak up and act. And now the best they can do, this latest vote by the British Parliament and the Swedish government, is to recognize something that doesn't exist, to pretend like they did something courageous, where in fact it is not going to help a single Palestinian child. It is not going to help a single Palestinian child who has been injured in this massive attack in Gaza. You've got thousands and thousands of children who are orphans, who are in hospitals, in need of urgent medical care. Not that they're going to get this. It's not going to help Palestinians get water that's much needed, because Israel distributes less water to Palestinians than it does to Israelis. It's not going to make life easier for Palestinian children who want to go to school and have to be harassed by settlers and go through the wall and so forth. What is this gesture? What does this mean? Why did they even bother? You know, why are they insulting our intelligence with this meaningless, useless vote? And I think we need to make this very, very clear that the world's not going to take it. We're not going to take this nonsense anymore.
Well, one of the things that characterizes much of the description of your book, which is subtitled "Journey of an Israeli in Palestine," was the way the Israelis had dehumanized the Palestinians and have dehumanized themselves. And this is something that I've noticed on my trips to the Middle East, beginning in the refugee camps in 1970 in Lebanon and Israel and West Bank and Gaza. But the thing that characterizes this treatment, and I don't know if this is true of all occupations or all thefts of someone else's land where you have to dehumanize the person you victimize, but there's a trait of sadism in the way the Israelis treat Palestinians of any age, whether they're old men, three times the age of a soldier, or small children who become target practice. How can this be changed?
Well, I don't think Israel invented anything. I mean, racist colonialist powers have done this. They did this here in North America, they did it in South America, they did it in Southeast Asia. You know, when white Europeans came to colonize people whose skin color was not white, they were brutal. I mean, racism and colonialism and brutality go hand in hand. These three are inseparable. There's no such thing as a benevolent racism or benevolent colonialism. So Israel hasn't invented anything, and naturally it is a brutal and cruel regime. The way you change it is by changing reality. The only way to change this is the way apartheid was forced to fall in South Africa, and the way Jim Crow was forced to fall here in the United States. People need to speak up. People need to force their congressmen and their senators and their local city council people to stop supporting Israel. There has to be a clear and unequivocal voice and call, I should say, to end support for Israel, to denounce Israel, to isolate Israel, to impose boycotts, sanctions, and to divest from Israel. Until the regime falls, until like apartheid fell and like Jim Crow fell and is replaced by a democracy. Once there is a democracy, once Israelis are forced to live with Palestinians as normal people do, with equality, with regard for each other's rights and so forth, then things will begin to change. Then you will see the history books change. Then you'll see attitudes change. It's not going to change before this happens. It's only going to change after this happens. You know, you couldn't convince whites in the South to stop being racists. You had to force the end of legalized racism. You had to make racism illegal. And then gradually change the education system and change, and then attitudes will change. That's how it's done. And Israelis are the same. Israelis are like the whites in South Africa. We are the children of colonizers and oppressors and settlers. We are now part of the landscape. We're not a natural part of the landscape, but we are part of the landscape now because this is our home, like the whites in South Africa. And so this is the reality now. But Israelis must know that they cannot continue living as masters of a land that belongs to somebody else, and they cannot maintain a regime that brutally oppresses another people.
Well, your book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, is with a foreword by Alice Walker, I should say, who lives in our neighborhood, is a remarkable tour. Your father was a leading general who I mentioned I had the great pleasure of meeting here in the Bay Area and then spending time with him on Yom Kippur in 1983. And although we had disagreements, we didn't argue, I wanted to listen to his thoughts. He was a remarkable man. And you had become a member of one of Israel's elite military units, proudly wearing a signature red beret. And you put this all behind you, become one of Israel's and its army's strongest and most important critics. This is an amazing, unusual journey. I know it partially began with the murder, with the killing of your niece, Smadar, in Jerusalem in a suicide attack in 1997. But take it from there.
Well, I was living here in the U.S. already at the time. And, of course, as soon as I heard, I took the first plane home. When I arrived at my sister's house, at her apartment, it was clear that this was bigger news than just any old, you know, attack, because one of the victims was the granddaughter of Matti Peled. So the press was there in unprecedented numbers, and people who came to express their sorrow, both Palestinians and Israelis, were there, you know, unprecedented numbers. And when my sister Nurit came out finally to talk to people after the funeral, you know, she answered a few questions in a way that had really propelled me to do something. I mean, I had the sense that I would probably have to do something. You can't just pretend like nothing happened after you see this little coffin go into the ground of a 13-year-old girl. But what Nurit said was that in terms of, you know, because people talk about retaliation and revenge and so forth. And she said, well, no real mother would want to see this happen to any other mother. In other words, don't talk to me about killing more people and creating more grief and more bereaved parents. It's absurd, it's humane, and I won't hear of it. And then in terms of who's responsible, which is the other question that's always asked, both she and her husband, Rami, actually very clearly pointed the finger at the Israeli government. And they said, well, when you maintain a brutal regime, a brutal occupation, where you take people's home and steal their lands and throw their fathers and brothers in jail and shoot their younger brothers and sisters in the schools and deprive them of water and freedom and life, what do we expect as a society? This is the price that we pay for supporting this brutality and for maintaining it. So this is no small thing. You know, I came back to the U.S. after all of that and felt, again, like I said, that I had to get involved. I had to do something. And my good fortune was that there was that I found a Jewish-Palestinian discussion group here in San Diego that had been active for some time, and I decided to join. And there I was for the first time in my life in the house of a Palestinian, sitting with Palestinians, meeting, talking like normal people. You know, even though I grew up in Jerusalem, I never met Palestinians because Jerusalem is a racist, segregated city. In fact, the chapter in the book that talks about this begins with the lines, "My journey into Palestine began in San Diego when I was 39 years old." And here I was with Palestinians, meeting them, but not only meeting them, but we were equals. You know, there was no need for them to have permits. There were no curfews, no checkpoints. The laws that applied to my life were the same laws that applied to their lives. There were no differences between us. And that is a very powerful experience. And what I realized through that experience is the potential of a relationship when you are equal, when you have no barriers between you. You can do a lot. You can, first of all, you can reach out and understand and hear each other. And then you can move on beyond that, which is what my journey, you know, really, that's what my journey expresses. And then I mustered up the, you know, the courage, if you will, to actually travel by myself into Palestinian communities, into the West Bank, and so forth, and gradually familiarize myself with this country that I grew up in but I didn't know, which is Palestine, and these people that were really my neighbors, but I never met, and these were the Palestinians. And having met them and having seen the country, I realized that there is no, well, two things. First of all, that there is no reason why we shouldn't live as equals, and it'll only be better for everyone. And number two, that Israel had established a single state over all of Palestine, not by mistake, but the day they took the West Bank in 1967, in June of 67, they established a single Jewish state, or they call it a Jewish state, the state of Israel over all of Palestine, and that's never going to change. So the only other solution, if we don't accept this, is to fight for a real democracy with equal rights over the entire country.
One of the things that you found, as I found when I traveled, was the lack of hatred upon the part of the Palestinians for Israelis or Jews as a people. And you were welcomed into Palestinian homes among Palestinian men you met who had spent years in prison, men whose brothers or fathers had been killed, and yet you were welcome, warmly welcomed. And I know this kind of probably came as a surprise to you, but it was the same experience that I found. Perhaps you could talk about that. They had not been dehumanized.
Yes, I think that's the thing that people comment on all the time, people who actually travel into Palestinian areas or areas in Palestine that are still populated by Palestinians and talk to them, is the sense of a desire, a strong, deep, on a very guttural level, a desire for reconciliation and just the creation of a normal life so that we can all move on beyond this. I sense this when I was in Gaza last year. I sense this every time I go into the West Bank or Palestinian areas, you know, in other parts of the country. This is probably the strongest and most powerful impression that people come out with, which people come out after they meet Palestinians. And this was, you're right, this was my experience too. The sense that there is a strong desire. Like I said, I was in Palestine. I was in Jerusalem now in the summer during this horrendous act of brutality by Israel against Gaza. It was an act of brutality that like I said, it was shocking. It was above and beyond anything Israel had done in recent years. And in speaking to Palestinians, you know, you said you take a taxi, you know, half the taxi drivers in Jerusalem are Palestinians. And you start talking and what people talk about is, let's, you know, we need to hold hands and move on beyond this. We need to show the world that we're better than this, as Israelis, as Palestinians, because there is no quarrel between Jews and Arabs. There is no quarrel between, you know, Jews and Muslims. There's an issue here with Israel. There's an issue here with this racist, brutal ideology called Zionism, and that's the problem. There's no problem between us as people. On the other hand, speaking to Israelis, again, whether it's a taxi driver or a soldier or whoever it is you talk to, the sentiment was, we need to kill more of them, we need to get more of them, we need to punish more of them, we need to destroy more of them. And I found that to be depressing on the one side, hearing the Israelis, and very uplifting in speaking with Palestinians. But you're right, this is the strongest impression that people get in speaking to Palestinians.
One of the things that I was intrigued by in the book is finding out, as you found out, why your father, General Matti Peled, had taken a course totally different than other Israeli generals have taken, and had become an advocate for Palestinian peace, and you, your amazement and going among Palestinians and learning that you were the son of Matti Peled, who they call Abu Salam, the father of peace, and then you discovered the incident in Gaza, which turned him into this advocate of peace. Perhaps you could talk about that.
Yes, this was really an interesting part of the journey. The manuscript had been complete, really, had been done, when I was on a visit in Palestine, and a friend of mine said, you know, there's somebody that wants to meet you, and because he knew I had an interest in the issue of the Palestinian prisoners, he said he was the leader of the Palestinian prisoner movement. In fact, he created it, and his name was Abu Ali Shaheen. And I went and I met this man and spent many, many, many hours in his apartment in Ramallah, speaking and, well, mostly listening, actually, over several days. And he told me this story, which I had to add into the book because it was so crucial. It was a story I'd never heard before, about an incident that took place in Gaza, where after the 1967 war, Israeli forces came into the neighborhood, into the refugee camp where his family was, and massacred family members in the neighborhood. Now, Abu Ali Shaheen was a commander of the Fatah movement. He was a military commander, and he was one of the, you know, three most wanted men for the Israeli military. And eventually he was captured, and he later on learned that my father had heard about this massacre that took place, and he himself decided to investigate, got in his jeep, drove alone to Gaza, drove to the neighborhood, talked to the people, and so forth. And what Abu Ali said was that he and others believed that this is what forced the change within my father, because he was a hawk, he was a strong militant man, he was a military man through and through, he was a staunch patriotic Zionist, and so forth. But of course, it's probably more than just that. I mean, I think there was also a realization that my father had that the only way to preserve the Zionist project, which is this Jewish state in Palestine, is by allowing the Palestinians certain rights and recognizing that they are part of the landscape. Otherwise, we will always be occupiers, and eventually we're going to be a binational state, be it a democracy or not democracy, but it's not going to be a Jewish state. And of course, he was right. But the thing is, you can't rein in racism, and you can't rein in colonialism. And that's why this two-state solution idea that was really established by my father and some others on the Israeli side and Yasser Arafat and a few others on the Palestinian side failed, because you can't rein in colonialist, racist regimes. You can only topple them if you want, if you know. So those are the choices. But yeah, that was a remarkable story. I mean, I tell it very quickly, briefly here, but it was a remarkable story, and I'm very fortunate that I was able to meet Abu Ali Shaheen. He passed away last year, and to hear this from him.
Well, I was very fortunate to read it because I never asked your father why he was different than the others. I remember escorting him to the Temple Emmanuel, large synagogue in San Francisco. He went in to speak, and I picked him up afterward, and he came out. He was in kind of a state of shock. He had called for stopping U.S. aid to Israel in 1983, when even the Palestine Solidarity Movement wasn't talking about it. And he came out, and he was shocked. He said, "I spoke, but the people didn't hear what I said."
Yeah.
And I remember I drove him. I had made a full schedule. It was at that time, it was easy to get someone like Matti Pellad an interview in the mainstream media. It would be impossible today, the way things are, at least in the San Francisco Bay Area. But he went and gave his message to the World Affairs Council. He was attacked as being a Nazi. He was then attacked by Palestinians as being a war criminal. And he took it all in stride. I mean, he was a military man. He was a very serious man, a serious thinker. But his story, which you brought out in your story, was to me a very, very important part for me in reading the book. What do you see? You mentioned what needs to be done. What about the educational system in Israel, in which, unlike yourself, so many young boys get indoctrinated into a belief system like it would happen, let's say, white South Africa, or in this country when we were committing genocide against the Native Americans? How do you change the educational system? How do you bring people together so that this hatred ends?
Yeah, that's an extremely important point. But before I answer it, I want to encourage the listeners to pledge and to remind everybody how important it is to have this sort of programming available to people, because, like you said, the mainstream media has become completely irrelevant on this issue. And if we want to get real insight and real news onto this particular issue and other important issues that the mainstream media doesn't dare touch, then we have to keep programs like this alive. So I hope that people are generous in their pledges today. I think the education system will change when the reality changes. Like I said before, once the apartheid regime changes, once Zionism falls, and I think it's going to be much sooner than most people think, and Israelis and Palestinians go to the polls as equals. They elect a legislative body that represents all the people. They elect an executive that represents all the people. One of the first things to do is you put together an education system that is appropriate for the new reality. When you are colonizing people and stealing their land, then you need to educate soldiers to be prepared to do that. And so you have to portray the native population as monsters, as illiterate, as dark, as incapable of making peace, incapable of civilized life and so forth. When you're creating something new, when you're presented with a reality where everybody now needs to recognize one another and appreciate each other's differences, then the first thing you need to do, one of the first things you need to do, is to create an education system that will develop that. And I think this will be done when Israelis and Palestinians are, like I said, represented in a legislative and executive bodies that represent them fairly and equally. This will be one of the first tasks, is to put together an appropriate education system.
Well, Miko Pellad, it's been my great pleasure to have you on the air. I'd love to keep on talking at the end of the hour. We have to thank you for giving us support to the radio station here. Miko Pellad, thanks. I hope to talk to you again at length on Takes on the World. And thanks so much for being our guest today and for writing that amazing book and doing the work you're doing.
Pleasure. Thank you so much.